Chapter 3. Passion, and may very likely end by running off with an heiress, or a cook maid, for who knows what strange freaks love may choose to play in his own particular person. And I hold a man to be a mean creature who calculates about checking any such sacred impulse as lawful love.
I say, though despising the sex in general for their conduct to me, I know of particular persons belonging to it who are worthy of all respect and esteem, and as such I beg leave to point out the particular young lady who is perusing these lines. Do not, dear madam, then imagine that, if I knew you, I should be disposed to sneer at you. Ah, no. Fitzpoodle's bosom has tenderer sentiments than from his way of life he would fancy, and stern by rule, is only too soft by practice. Shall I whisper to you the story of one or two of my attachments? All terminating fatally, not in death, but in disappointment, which, as it occurred, I used to imagine a thousand times more bitter than death, but from which one recovers somehow more readily than from the other named complaint.
All, I say, terminating wretchedly to myself, as if some fatality pursued my desire to become a domestic character. Asterisk, he is 45, if he is a day old.
Oh, why, my first love, no, let us pass that over.
Sweet one, thy name shall profane no hireling page.
Sweet, sweet memory.
Ah, ladies, those delicate hearts of yours have too felt the throb. And between the last ob in the word throb and the words now written, I have passed a delicious period of perhaps an hour, perhaps a minute, I know not how long, thinking of that holy first love, and of her who inspired it. How clearly every single incident of the passion is remembered by me. And yet 'twas long, long since. I was but a child then, a child at school, and, if the truth must be told, 50. R-R-G-G-L-S.
I would not write her whole name to be made one of the Marquess of Hartford's executors,
was a woman full 13 years older than myself. At the period of which I write she must have been at least 25. She and her mother used to sell tarts, hardbake, lollipops, and other such simple comestibles, on Wednesdays and Saturdays,
half-holidays,
at a private school, where I received the first rudiments of a classical education. I used to go and sit before her tray for hours, but I do not think the poor girl ever supposed any motive led me so constantly to her little stall beyond a vulgar longing for her tarts and her ginger beer. Yes, even at that early period my actions were misrepresented, and the fatality which has oppressed my whole life began to show itself. The purest passion was misinterpreted by her, and my schoolfellows, and they thought I was actuated by simple gluttony. They nicknamed me Alicompane. Well, be it so. Laugh at early passion he who will, a high-born boy madly in love with a lowly ginger beer girl. She married afterwards. Took the name of Ladder, and now keeps with her old husband a turnpike, through which I often ride. But I can recollect her bright and rosy of a sunny summer afternoon, her red cheeks shaded by a battered straw bonnet, her tarts and ginger beer upon the neat white cloth before her, mending blue worsted stockings until the young gentleman should interrupt her by coming to buy. Many persons will call this description low. I do not envy them their gentility, and have always observed through life,
as, to be sure, every other gentleman has observed as well as myself,
that it is your parvenu who stickles most for what he calls the genteel, and has the most squeamish abhorrence for what is frank and natural. Let us pass at once, however, as all the world must be pleased, to a recital of an affair which occurred in the very best circles of society, as they are called, viz., my next unfortunate attachment. It did not occur for several years after that simple and platonic passion just described. For though they may talk of youth as the season of romance, it has always appeared to me that there are no beings in the world so entirely unromantic and selfish as certain young English gentlemen from the age of 15 to 20. The oldest Lovelace about town is scarcely more hard-hearted and scornful than they ape all sorts of selfishness and drowry.
They aim at excelling at cricket, at billiards, at rowing, and drinking, and set more store by a red coat and a neat pair of top boots than by any other glory. A young fellow staggers into college chapel of a morning and communicates to all his friends that he was O-cut last night with the greatest possible pride. He makes a joke of having sisters and a kind mother at home who loves him, and if he speaks of his father, it is with a knowing sneer to say that he has a tailor's and a horse dealer's bill that will surprise the old governor. He would be ashamed of being in love. I, in common with my kind, had these affectations, and my perpetual custom of smoking added not a little to my reputation as an accomplished rowdy. What came of this custom in the army and at college, the reader has already heard. Alas! In life it went no better with me, and many pretty chances I had went off in that accursed smoke. After quitting the army in the abrupt manner stated, I passed some short time at home, and was tolerated by my mother-in-law, because I had formed an attachment to a young lady of good connections, and with a considerable fortune, which was really very nearly becoming mine. Mary Malister was the only daughter of Colonel Malister, late of the Blues, and Lady Susan his wife. Her ladyship was no more, and, indeed, of no family compared to ours, which has refused a peerage any time these 200 years, but being an earl's daughter and a Scotchwoman, Lady Emily Fitzpoodle did not fail to consider her highly. Lady Susan was daughter of the late Admiral Earl of Marlingspike and Baron Plumduff. The Colonel, Miss Malister's father, had a good estate, of which his daughter was the heiress, and as I fished her out of the water upon a pleasure party, and swam with her to shore, we became naturally intimate, and Colonel Malister forgot, on account of the service rendered to him, the dreadful reputation for profligacy which I enjoyed in the county. Well, to cut a long story short, which is told here merely for the moral at the end of it, I should have been Fitzpoodle Malister at this minute most probably, and master of 4,000 a year, but for the fatal cigar box. I bear Mary no malice in saying that she was a high-spirited little girl, loving, before all things, her own way. Nay, perhaps I do not, from long habit and indulgence in tobacco smoking, appreciate the delicacy of female organizations, which were oftentimes most painfully affected by it. She was a keen-sighted little person, and soon found that the world had belied poor George Fitzpoodle, who, instead of being the cunning monster people supposed him to be, was a simple, reckless, good-humored, honest fellow, marvelously addicted to smoking, idleness, and telling the truth. She called me Orson, and I was happy enough on the 14th February, in the year 18, it's of no consequence, to send her such a pretty little copy of verses about Orson and Valentine, in which the rude habits of the savage man were shown to be overcome by the polished graces of his kind and brilliant conqueror, that she was fairly overcome, and said to me, George Fitzpoodle, if you give up smoking for a year, I will marry you. I swore I would, of course, and went home and flung 4 pounds of Hudson cigars, 2 meerschaum pipes that had cost me 10 guineas at the establishment of Mr. Gaddy at Oxford, a tobacco bag that Lady Fitzpoodle had given me before her marriage with my father. It was the only present that I ever had from her, or any member of the Flintskinner family, and some choice packets of Verena's and Syrian, into the lake in Bootle Park. The weapon amongst them all which I most regretted was, will it be believed, the little black doudine which had been the cause of the quarrel between Lord Martingale and me. However, it went along with the others. I would not allow my groom to have so much as a cigar, lest I should be tempted hereafter. And the consequence was that a few days after, many fat carps and tenches in the lake, I must confess, was no bigger than a pond, nibbled at the tobacco, and came floating on their backs on the top of the water quite intoxicated. My conversion made some noise in the county, being emphasized as it were by this fact of the fish. I can't tell you with what pangs I kept my resolution, but keep it, I did for some time. With so much beauty and wealth, Mary Mallister had of course many suitors, and among them was the young Lord Audley, whose mama has previously been described in her gown of red satin. As I used to thrash Audley at school, I thrashed him in after life in love. He put up with his disappointment pretty well, and came after a while, and shook hands with me, telling me of the bets that there were in the county, where the whole story was known, for and against me. For the fact is, as I must own, that Mary Mallister, the queerest, frankest of women, made no secret of the agreement, or the cause of it. I did not care a penny for Orson, she said, but he would go on writing me such dear pretty verses, that at last I couldn't help saying yes. But if he breaks his promise to me, I declare, upon my honor, I'll break mine, and nobody's heart will be broken either. This was the perfect fact, as I must confess, and I declare that it was only because she amused me and delighted me, and provoked me, and made me laugh very much, and because, no doubt, she was very rich, that I had any attachment for her. For heaven's sake, George, my father said to me, as I quitted home, to follow my beloved to London, remember that you are a younger brother, and have a lovely girl and 4,000 a year within a year's reach of you. Smoke as much as you like, my boy, after marriage, added the old gentleman, knowingly as if he, honest soul, after his second marriage, dared drink an extra pint of wine without my lady's permission. I'd eschew the tobacco shops till then. I went to London resolving to act upon the paternal advice, and oh, how I longed for the day when I should be married, vowing in my secret soul that I would light a cigar as I walked out of St. George's, Hanover Square. Well, I came to London, and so carefully avoided smoking that I would not even go into Hudson's shop to pay his bill, and as smoking was not the fashion then among young men as, thank heaven, it is now, I had not many temptations from my friends' examples in my clubs or elsewhere. Only little Audley began to smoke, as if to spite me. He had never done so before, but confessed the rascal, that he enjoyed a cigar now, if it were but to mortify me. But I took to other and more dangerous excitements, and upon the nights, when not in attendance upon Mary Mallister, might be found in very dangerous proximity to a polished mahogany table, round which claret bottles circulated a great deal too often, or worse still, to a table covered with green cloth, and ornamented with a couple of wax candles, and a couple of packs of cards, and four gentlemen playing the enticing game of whist. Likewise, I came to carry a snuff box, and to consume in secret huge quantities of rapee. For ladies' society I was even then disinclined, hating and despising small talk, and dancing, and hot routs, and vulgar scrambles for suppers. I never could understand the pleasure of acting the part of lackey to a dowager, and standing behind her chair, or bustling through the crowd for her carriage. I always found an opera too long by two acts, and have repeatedly fallen asleep in the presence of Mary Mallister herself, sitting at the back of the box shaded by the huge beret of her old aunt, Lady Betty Plumduff. And many a time has Audley, with Miss Mallister on his arm, wakened me up at the close of the entertainment in time to offer my hand to Lady Betty, and lead the ladies to their carriage. If I attended her occasionally to any ball or party of pleasure, I went, it must be confessed, with clumsy, ill-disguised ill humor. Good heavens! Have I often and often thought in the midst of a song, or the very thick of a ballroom, can people prefer this to a book and a sofa, and a dear, dear cigar box, from thy stores, O charming Mariana Woodville? Deprived of my favorite plant, I grew sick in mind and body, moody, sarcastic, and discontented. Such a state of things could not long continue, nor could Miss Mallister continue to have much attachment for such a sullen, ill-conditioned creature as I then was. She used to make me wild with her wit and her sarcasm, nor have I ever possessed the readiness to parry or reply to those fine points of woman's wit, and she treated me the more mercilessly as she saw that I could not resist her. Well, the polite reader must remember a great fête that was given at B House, some years back, in honor of His Highness the Hereditary Prince of Kalbsbrit and Pumpernickel, who was then in London on a visit to his illustrious relatives. It was a fancy ball, and the poems of Scott being at that time all the fashion, Mary was to appear in the character of the Addy of the Lake, old Malister making a very tall and severe-looking harper. Dodley, a most insignificant Fitzjames, and your humble servant a stalwart manly Roderick too. We were to meet at B House at 12 o'clock, and as I had no fancy to drive through the town in my cab dressed in a kilt and filibeg, I agreed to take a seat in Dodley's carriage, and to dress at his house in Mayfair. At 11 I left a very pleasant bachelor's party, growling to quit them and the honest, jovial claret bottle, in order to scrape and cut capers like a harlequin from the theater. When I arrived at Dodley's, I mounted to a dressing room and began to array myself in my cursed costume. The art of costuming was by no means so well understood in those days as it has been since, and mine was out of all correctness. I was made to sport an enormous plume of black ostrich feathers, such as never was worn by any Highland chief, and had a huge tiger skin sporran to dangle like an apron before innumerable yards of plaid petticoat. The tartan cloak was outrageously hot and voluminous. It was the dog days, and all these things I was condemned to wear in the midst of a crowd of 1,000 people. Dodley sent up word, as I was dressing, that his dress had not arrived, and he took my cab, and drove off in a rage to his tailor. There was no hurry, I thought, to make a fool of myself, so having put on a pair of plaid trews, and very neat pumps with shoe buckles, my courage failed me, as to the rest of the dress, and taking down one of his dressing gowns, I went downstairs to the study, to wait until he should arrive. The windows of the pretty room were open, and a snug sofa, with innumerable cushions, drawn towards one of them. A great tranquil moon was staring into the chamber, in which stood, amidst books and all sorts of bachelor's lumber, a silver tray with a couple of tall Venice glasses, and a bottle of maraschino bound with straw. I can see now the twinkle of the liquor in the moonshine, as I poured it into the glass. And I swallowed 2 or 3 little cups of it, for my spirits were downcast. Close to the tray of maraschino stood, must I say it? A box, a mere box of cedar, bound rudely together with pink paper, branded with the name of Utzon on the side, and bearing on the cover the arms of Spain. I thought I would just take up the box and look in it. Ah, heaven! There they were, 150 of them, in calm, comfortable rows. Lovingly side by side they lay, with the great moon shining down upon them thin at the tip, full in the waist, elegantly round and full, a little spot here and there shining upon them, beauty spots upon the cheek of Sylvia. The house was quite quiet. Dodley always smoked in his room. I had not smoked for 4 months and 11 days. When Lord Dodley came into the study, he did not make any remarks. And oh, how easy my heart felt. He was dressed in his green and boots, after Westall's picture, correctly. It's time to be off, George, said he. They told me you were dressed long ago. Come up, my man, and get ready. I rushed up into the dressing room, and madly dashed my head and arms into a pool of eau de cologne. I drank, I believe, a tumblerful of it. I called for my clothes, and, strange to say, they were gone. My servant brought them, however, saying that he had put them away, making some stupid excuse. I put them on, not heeding them much, for I was half tipsy with the excitement of the sea, of the smoke, of what had taken place in Dodley's study, and with the maraschino and the eau de cologne I had drunk. What a fine odor of lavender water, said Dodley, as we rode in the carriage. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.